What you should know psychologically about infertility and embryo adoption. That's what we're talking about on this edition of the Embryo Adoption Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Mark Mellinger, and joining me is Dr. Megan Hersher, who is a psychologist and also an NEDC mom. By the way, she's the Associate Professor of Counseling and Clinical Mental Health Program Coordinator. That's a mouthful. Sorry. Yeah. At Carson Newman University, just down the road from us here in Knoxville. And Megan, what a joy to have you. I did not meet you when you came through the NEDC. You were here for the transfer just before my time, but through a mutual connection, I was made aware of you and thought, golly, this is such a big deal in terms of psychology of infertility and embryo adoption. So thank you for setting aside the time to talk with us about this. First of all, let's sort of just go through your story. Describe your own infertility journey and how it led you to the NEDC.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. It's interesting to tell my story in this forum because I think I kind of share it intermittently with people. And when I hear that people are struggling with infertility, I always kind of refer them to the NEDC. And you and I have spoke about how maybe some of those have resulted in babies as well.
So. Oh, some of them definitely have. There's no maybe about it. So if I could put you on the payroll, I would.
Well, it's been a tremendous blessing to us, to me and to my family. So yeah, we were able to have our daughter who's 12 biologically. You know, there were some fertility issues that required medical intervention, but those medical interventions made it possible for us to conceive her, and she is 12 now. But after that, we, you know, were hoping for another baby, and some time went by and we realized that kind of a lot of the infertility interventions were not effective for us, and that we never really got a definite no about IVF, but it just didn't look like it was going to happen for us. And also looked at traditional adoption, and that was something that felt really iffy as well. And the thing that I thought was really most comforting about Dr. Keenan and the team over there was that they indicated they would continue to work with us until, you know, that this was something that would likely happen. My odds went from 12%, 15% to, you know, we'll try it. And if it doesn't happen again, we'll try it again and we'll try it again. And so that felt like finally a real guarantee. Yeah. So I was at a professional conference this past weekend, and I left that very same conference 7 years ago, drove to Knoxville and had my embryos implanted. So that's, yeah.
Wow.
And ours is unique because we had chosen embryos from a couple of different donors, and a couple of those did not make it. So we ended up having embryos from two different biological families. So my sons are twins in the fact that I carried them, but they are biologically from two sets of families. So they are biologically not related to each other or to me. Yeah. So we've got a great family with a lot of different characteristics.
So it was what we call a mixed transfer. And it's good to mention that, because that does happen sometimes with the NEDC. And what happens in that case, the way you find out which donor they were from is you do DNA testing after they're born. That's usually just a cheek swab. How long did it take you to get the results back on that, Megan?
Mark, you never did it. Never did it because I just know. I don't know. I need to do it, but I have the profile still, and my boys look strikingly different. One has, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes. The other one has an olive complexion, and I still have their profiles. And I think I know.
Well, let me clarify. You don't need to do it. I mean, we're not going to tell you need to do it. In a case like that, I think you have a pretty good idea, and you're their mom. You would know.
Yeah. Well, and I just love to, one of the profiles had the parents' favorite song on there. And those are things that I think are just so neat to be connected to, you know, the lyrics from This Must Be the Place. And we actually have them. They are very profound to me when it speaks to This Must Be the Place. Like, this was supposed to be my son, you know, and we have them painted on the wall over there because it means so much to us to think about that connection.
Oh, man. How nice. That's just great. Well, and I don't even know that song. I'll confess, I don't even know that song. I don't know who sings it.
Yeah, it's the Talking Heads. the lyrics, I would listen to them when I was pregnant, and the lyrics are very profound. Like, I didn't know this was supposed to be my home, this, you know. So that's, yeah. Yeah, we'll take a listen to it, and particularly if you're dealing with the hormones of being pregnant with twins, it might really move you.
Yeah, I haven't checked out the Talking Heads in a while. If I get nostalgic for a little 80s when I was a kid, uh-huh. I guess I'll go look it up. This Must Be the Place. Well, let's talk about the other things we wanted to talk about. How does the experience of infertility affect both couples and individuals psychologically? Because what you hear is that there are a few things that really heighten chances of divorce. And of course, there's some of the things that you would think of, like financial problems, the death of a child. But also, I have heard that infertility can be a strain that also can increase likelihood of divorce. I don't know if that's true, but the bottom line is it's a big psychological blow.
It certainly is. And I think that, you know, without being sexist, men and women typically grieve things in different ways. And I think that women who are going through particularly fertility loss, if there's a miscarriage, you know, the series of medical procedures, shots, invasive procedures that lead up to hoping for a pregnancy, the hormonal fluctuations, a lot of times women will feel it kind of in a different way than men. And then that kind of brings some level of a conflict where men and women are grieving or wanting that in a different way. One of the things that I heard was that, you know, women become mothers when they realize that they're pregnant, and men become fathers when they have a baby being born. And I don't think that's always true, but I think, you know, just even, you know, recalling in my relationship, like, okay, well, it's like the 2-week wait. How are we going to handle that? And my husband's like, well, you know, we're just going to wait. And I'm like, well, I said not to take a pregnancy test, but maybe I should just take one. And, you know, so there's that factor. And then I think also, on a larger scale, contextually with family, there can be some real challenges with that, where the pressure is placed on the woman. A lot of a woman's femininity, her identity is associated with being a woman. People feel, are often well-intentioned, but feel very comfortable asking, you know, why haven't you had any children yet? Or what are you guys going to have any children, when, you know, there could have been a miscarriage, or there could have been, you know, there could be difficulties associated with becoming pregnant. And all of those things create stress, certainly, and create stress because I think when at least women expect sometimes that their partner will grieve the same way that they are, or experience emotions the same way that they are. And I think that disconnect can really create some stress.
So that's one thing you would say to couples experiencing infertility: realize that you will both likely grieve differently and allow some space for that. Anything else you would say to couples experiencing infertility? Any other tips that they should keep in mind for dealing with it in a healthy way? And dealing with it can mean everything from, right, like you said, privately grieving the apparent inability to conceive a child, to having to deal with nosy friends or relatives who will ask them annoying questions or say insensitive things about it.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I as a counselor, always see value in processing through things with a third party. But I understand also that that's not for everyone. I think coming together in a place of calm when we're not feeling heightened, when we didn't just get a negative pregnancy test back, when we're looking at the trajectory and really kind of having a conversation about, like, how are we going to handle those questions from the churchgoers or from the people at work? How are we going to handle baby showers? Or how are we going to handle your sister getting pregnant, you know, your brother's family having another one? How are we going to handle kind of coming up with kind of the company line? So there's that united front between the two of them. And also for us, there is so much of an expenditure when you're involved in the infertility process. It's financial, emotional, time, all of those things. And we had to kind of decide that there would be a point that we determined that this family was the way that it was supposed to be. So I think having a finite, like, so we're going to try this many transfers. And for us, this was it. The twins were it. Like, we decided, you know, we did several IUIs, we did several surgeries. We had a beautiful daughter. We would have loved for her to have a sibling, but we just said, like, if this doesn't work, we're going to call it. And that was kind of a commitment we made together. So finding that middle ground, so it doesn't feel like everything is so up in the air, that really helped us.
That's really, really good. And you mentioned that you have a 12-year-old daughter. You also have the two sons from embryo adoption who are now 7.5 years old. They'll turn 8 very late this year. So I'm interested, Megan, do we know if embryo adoption kids in general, and you have firsthand experience with this now, process life and sense of well-being any differently than other kids? Is the extra in their story psychologically affecting them at all in a general sense?
That's such a good question, because I often work with people who are from a traditional adoption, where they were, you know, adopted at birth from the birth parent and handed over to another family. And I do see that there can be long-term identity issues associated with that. You know, colleagues of mine who are clinicians went into the field because they're adopted, and they can feel often a sense of rejection or uncertainty or wanting to seek out who their, you know, who the other partner was who conceived them. And I think it really depends on the person in that capacity. The irony about the twins being adopted through embryo adoption is I think we went to the 500th birth party when I was pregnant with them. So we are in such an early stage of this, you know what I'm saying? Like, families, you know, infertility is increasing. Women are choosing to have children later. There are factors, you know, both within the United States and worldwide that are contributing to people taking more non-traditional routes to have their children. So as that occurs, you know, 10, 12, 18 years later, we kind of see what comes of that. We're still in such an early, early stage. You know, there's a great book that you guys have on your website, Chosen and Loved. And they had that physically in the office when we were there. And I've read that to my twins and they don't seem to care.
I love it. You got to be straight. If that's how it is, that's how it is.
They're like, okay. And so particularly with traditional adoption, which is like really all I have to base it off of right now, Mark, you know, and I think I would love to get into doing studies. And even like, I know there's a board member whose children are in their teens, and I spent some time with them recently and they seem lovely and well-adjusted and it doesn't seem to be a thing. So I think we all need to find our common ground of how much do we talk about this? How much is this a thing? It will never be hidden. It should never be a secret, right? Because the inference then is shame, or, you know, that we shouldn't tell anyone because it's bad. So we want to start out early sharing that with them. But then I think I myself have struggled with the developmental level at which they are able to absorb that information.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at their age, do they get it at all?
I have tried to. I've recently discussed this with them. They do not seem to see any distinction between themselves and anyone else. And then my daughter, whenever we just, again, like, I want to be so open with it because we got to make sure I'm the therapist mother who's going to make all the mistakes, you know, this is how they came from and they're not quite the same. And so, you know, one time I think my girl was about 7, and I think, I don't know, what the twins were doing something crazy at age 2. And she was like, you know, Mom, they're not one of us. They're not like us. And I was like, okay, no, that's not it. And then, you know, even asking, like, trying to have, like, well, do you know where babies come from? And they're like, oh, yeah, like, you go down on Kingston Pike and you go to the doctor. And Dr. Keenan gives mommy two of them. I'm like, well, don't tell it.
I mean, that, here, but it's a good point. I mean, sometimes as a parent, you can probably put too much of a burden on yourself, especially when they're young like that, because like 7 and 8 year olds, especially boys, that's just not a category they generally think in or care about. And that seems to me like that's okay.
Yes, they're more focused on that they were born the same. Their little birth story is that they were born the same minute. Like, so one came out and then 30 seconds later, the other one came out. And so that's like, that's kind of, you know, all kids kind of have like a narrative that they adopt about who they are. And it's like, this is my brother. We were born the same minute. And it's, it, and again, I'll continue to make that information available to them. But I think I've done my due diligence. And I think that other parents, all you can do is really do your due diligence by saying like, this is where you came from. I love you so much. If you ever want to talk about it, let's talk about it, but not pushing too hard to say like, would you like to discuss it? Because then I think then it in itself becomes something that's like, well, why would we want to talk about where I'm from, but not my sister, you know?
That's good. That's good. Just letting them know you're available. It's a good principle for parenting in general, and especially on this issue. Do you have any tips for families who've adopted embryos, maybe even those who've donated them, for how they can work toward emotionally whole, healthy lives for themselves and their kids? I mean, I think you just really articulated a very important point, which is openness. Anything else that's unique to embryo donation or embryo adoption in that regard?
Gosh, I think it just is so unique, Mark. And I think we're still in a place where we'll see kind of how things unfold and how things are unpacked as time goes on. But I think that I kind of thought to myself, okay, so what happens when these boys are in middle school? What happens when they're in high school? And I think the family unit is not, you know, a mom and a dad conceive three kids and there we go. We have, you know, children who are adopted by grandparents. We have children who, you know, are adopted through traditional adoption. We have IVF babies. We have surrogacy babies. We have egg donation. We have sperm donation. So my hope is that the baseline of who their peers are will become more diverse as ways to build a family become more innovative. And that will really normalize things for them.
And I think that that is going to happen. You're right. That seems like sort of how society is going. So before we go, I didn't want to get away or let you get away without talking about a new book that you've collaborated on. It sounds really good. And you've been gracious enough to say that you'll give us here at the NEDC a copy when it publishes. The book is going to be called Working with Infertility and Grief, a practical guide for helping professionals. So this had to be exciting and I'm sure hard work. Tell me about it.
Yes. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to speak about it. So I wrote this book with two other colleagues from University of Tennessee who both had struggled with infertility. So the three of us worked together. And the irony is that kind of the three of us all had different outcomes with where we ended up. You know, one of them, you know, you know, we did adopted embryos. Another author did adopted embryos and another author had, you know, a baby and then just felt that this book was her second child. Most of the understanding that we have is that, like, as I was saying earlier, you know, that this is a grieving and emotionally really challenging part of people's lives that is often kept private. And therefore we often lack the support of peers and family that would be brought to the table if we were dealing with other types of grief and loss. And the truth is, you know, there is, whether you have one bump in the road with infertility or whether you are not able to have a biological child yourself or whether you're not able to have any children yourself, That represents a difference from what you expected for yourself. It, you know, and I interviewed lots of women and men, like, well, when I grew up, I knew I would be a mom. I knew I would be a dad. I knew that that would be a part of who I was. And there's a loss when that doesn't come to fruition, or when it doesn't come to fruition in the way that you expected it to come. And so the book speaks to clinicians, physicians, as well as the general population, you know, with chapters on male infertility. So, you know, less commonly there's male factor infertility, and that can bring a set of challenges for that person. You know, fertility loss, you know, grappling with spirituality in the wake of all this, really, really addressing kind of all of the experiences of people who struggle with this and who often struggle really quietly.
So it is readable and accessible to the layman. It's, even though it's for clinicians, it's not just solely an academic book.
No, it's kind of really an easy read. It uses kind of the literary construct of the hero's journey and the woman. Again, it was a tough decision to call the woman the hero, but the woman is typically the hero in this experience where she has a journey of infertility and comes out the other side, you know, whether with her original goal or not, but changed by the journey. And that it can be, for me, this book is affirming. It allows you to feel comfortable feeling all the emotions you have associated with infertility, dealing with the issues you have maybe with your family or your partner through this journey, and figuring out a way to come to peace with the outcome, regardless of what it is.
Let me ask you something that I've thought about before, and this is a total wild card, so I'm catching you off guard, but it piggybacks off of the topic of your book. As a Christian, especially, this is an important question, at least I think it is. What is the difference between an appropriate lament? We know that lament has a place in the Christian life. You don't just have to be glib when you are experiencing tragedy. There is a sense in which you can certainly camp out on that. David does it in the Psalms quite a bit. But what's, how do we know where the line is between lament and then an unhealthy sense of self-pity in the face of legitimate tragedy or trauma?
Yes, yes. And that is truly for each person's journey, you know? You know, Ken Doka, during pandemic, he works with the Hospice Foundation, and he coined the term disenfranchised grief, which was kind of originally for people who lost loved ones and were unable to have the ritual of a funeral during pandemic, and that their grieving process was different and more difficult because they lacked that traditional way of grieving. So I think for each person, they are experiencing disenfranchised grief in a lot of ways. And I think there can be that kind of sense of existential, this is what's supposed to be, this is the plan for me. But everybody hits that at a different mark, you know? And I think that we just have to kind of allow ourselves the time to not go to baby showers, the time to take a break from first birthday parties, the time to not live our lives, but do things that are protective to ourselves in order to be well as an individual and be well, you know, with you and your husband or your partner.
And seek help, like you said, from a third party. That would be a counseling or therapist sort of relationship if you need to. I think most people who are going through something significant like this should at least spend a couple sessions with a therapist.
Absolutely. I mean, I obviously am a very strong advocate of talk therapy. I'm a very strong advocate of talk therapy for individuals, for couples, for families as a whole. And I think that having a third party there, bringing a different perspective in such an emotionally charged place, is huge.
The book is called Working with Infertility and Grief, a practical guide for helping professionals. And Dr. Megan Hersher is one of the collaborators on it. So write that down, tuck it away in your memory. Megan, it has been great talking with you. Such a helpful conversation. And we're very thankful that you were able to add not just one, but two more little siblings for your daughter through the National Embryo Donation Center.
Yes. Yes. It's quite a blessing. We have a lovely family.
Well, congratulations, Dr. Megan Hersher, my guest. I'm Mark Mellinger. This has been the Embryo Adoption Podcast. If you want to find out more about the NEDC and our work, just go to our website. It's embryodonation.org.